All right, thank you very much. Mr. Dumont, you're next. Welcome to the court. Good afternoon to you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I guess it goes without saying that there's no point in restating anything that Ms. Keene said with which you agree, but if you have important things to add, that would help us.
Well, let me try my hypothetical out on you. Do you remember that we have a situation in which there's no joint development of technology? Two companies get together, pool their patents to set a standard, and they agree to suppress an alternative technology represented by other patents that they own. First of all, is that an antitrust violation?
It could be under particular facts and circumstances, but the important point, we think, for present purposes is the order and the content of the analysis that you do in order to get there. And the first step would not be jumping straight to, well, the first step would be for the challenger to clearly identify the restraint that's being challenged and to make some threshold showing that it has an actual anti-competitive effect and therefore it is necessary and worth it to go and do the rest of the analysis.
What about under an inherently suspect standard? Doesn't your client under that approach have the obligation to come in and address justifications?
Well, a lot of the action here on the antitrust issue, if you will, on the rule of reason issue, has to do with that threshold question. Who has the burden of articulating a problem, and then how does the order of production and the burden of proof flow from that?
Well, that's,
I don't think that we disagree. Let me just say this. I don't think that we would have to disagree with the FTC on the way that they frame the inherently suspect standard depending on how you apply it, right? And so if they require a sufficient threshold showing on a sufficient complex of actual facts to really allow the court to be able to say with some confidence, all right, I've looked at this and I think this is a serious problem, then I think it may make sense to put the next burden on the proponent of the restraint, the person who the defendant,
Phillips,
to come forward and justify that. But there is a lot packed into that first question, which is how much do you require the challenger to do before you engage?
Okay, so how much would you require? If there's an alternative technology, and in my hypothetical that's suppressed, does that shift the burden to come up with a justification to Phillips?
In the situation that you posit, I think the answer is no, because I think it's designed to be similar to this one in the following respect. We have two parties that have agreed to collaborate on the standardization and commercialization of a technology, right? Now, you stipulated that they didn't collaborate on the
development. Yeah, I'm putting that aside, because I understand the
right.
point.
So it's a harder problem that we have here, but there's still legitimate joint integrative activity going on, as I understand hypothetical, and therefore an agreement by them not only to jointly commercialize the technology, but for each of them to hold aside other potentially competing technology and not to license that in competition with their own standard, that would be an ancillary restraint. It would be a classic limited agreement not to compete in purported support of pro-competitive joint activity. And under those circumstances, by articulating that, the defendant, Phillips in this case, puts that in a class of restraints which for 100 plus years has been recognized as potentially pro-competitive.
Even though there was no joint development of the technology?
Even though there was no joint development. Now, it makes it a harder case when we get to the ultimate balancing about whether it is on balance justified or not, because it may be harder for the defendant to show in your hypothetical that it was, the term being reasonably necessary, that it was reasonably necessary to facilitate or enable the collaboration.
So that would have to be part of the analysis.
That becomes part of the analysis.
Okay, how can we possibly decide that question of reasonable necessity under your theory on this record?
Well, you can't, which Which brings us to the point of this case. I mean, there's a set of theoretical questions here that engage the en banc court. They're important, and you want to articulate proper principles for them. And then there's a question about what to do in this case. And that's leaving aside waiver. I'm not talking about waiver. But in this case, the reason that the record is, well, we think the record favors us such as it is. It favors us strongly. And those points are set out in our brief. But to the extent that you look at the record, and I would not blame you, and you find that there are unresolved questions, there are things you would like to know, there are witnesses you would like to have heard from, the reason that you don't have that in the record is that this issue, this agreement, was never alleged when the record was open, and Phillips had no opportunity and no reason to meet this showing. And so, in terms of this case...
When you say disagreement, you mean an agreement to suppress a potential alternative technology?
Exactly.
That wasn't proven.
It wasn't proven. It was never alleged.
Not alleged either. And you seem to be saying that that would be step one before any burden of coming forward or burden of proof would shift to the other side.
Well, step one is to allege it.
Well, suppose they did. Right? Suppose hypothetically that we conclude that they did allege it. What should we do? Should we send it back for the development of a fuller record, or should we try to decide it on this record?
No, you should not send it back, because the answer is, as the panel's opinion recognizes, if we're talking about an agreement, which we are, an agreement not for Sony not to license the Lagodec patent, it isn't even clear on this record whether that agreement existed. There's no finding, and the reason that there's no finding is not because Prinko asked for one and the commission refused to supply it. Now, in that situation, I would say, fine, you can send it back to the commission for that finding. That's not what happened here. Because the issue was never clearly raised...
But I'm asking you to assume hypothetically that it was raised. I'm asking you to assume that we conclude that it was raised.
Right.
And so can we decide these issues on this record, or if it was properly raised, should we be sending it back to have a proper record developed, both on the agreement point, on the competitiveness point, on the justification point? Why should those issues be decided on what you seem to agree also is a skimpy record?
Because the critical question as to this case is who bears the burden, who bore the burden of proof, and who bears the risk of an inadequate record.
But isn't the
precursor question to that whether the discussion that you've been having with Judge Dyke, which is, I understand it, is in terms of antitrust, translates directly into patent misuse? Because whatever the outcome might be with respect to the antitrust liability that might flow from such an agreement, this is a patent misuse case, and the question has to be, does the horizontal agreement that is alleged, or at least is that we've been talking about, does that constitute misuse of the Raymaker's patents? I understood your position on that to be no. Without any of the discussion, without any of the analysis of the particular facts of the agreement. Am I overstating your position?
No, not at all. That's exactly right. And the only thing I would add to that, we've laid out, and I can go through again, why we think this is just true, that it goes beyond any previous case. And we think there's no reason to go beyond any previous case, because the antitrust laws are there if there's a problem. And as a functional matter, the antitrust laws allow you to have a much more... They have standing requirements, first of all, which are important, and they allow you to have a much more tailored remedy. In misuse, you have quite a draconian remedy, and the reason that it may make sense in the limited context in which it's been applied by the Supreme Court and this court is that you were talking about something that's quite cabin. You're talking only about use of the patent that's actually before the court, that the plaintiff, the patentee, brought before the court to do something that expands the patent beyond its scope. And the facts that are necessary to make a misuse determination will almost certainly be evident from the face of the record, from the face of the license agreement and the basic facts involved. Now, what we're talking about here is something quite different, which goes far beyond that, and will turn every case into an antitrust case.
No, but are we really doing that if, in fact, we have a situation where the agreement to do a joint venture for development gives rise to different types of patents, and then the patents themselves are used for a pool, and the two parties agreed to only take one set of the patents? versus the other and develop only one part of the patents and then use those patents within the pool and leave the others out? If, in fact, you have two technologies and A and B decide back in 1986 to develop one technology over the other, and that technology provides for one set of patents, another set of patents that could also be developed, and in the process you have a pool, but only the patents that are developed by one side are put in the pool, the others are kept out, even though they could be used within the pool. Is that patent misuse or is that antitrust violations?
If all the licensors are doing with the patents that they have decided to use and license to the community is enforcing them against licensees who, forcing them against people who declined to take a license or are not complying with the license, enforcing against infringers, that is not misuse. Now, if there are collateral agreements that they've made that turn out to present antitrust questions, that should be resolved as a matter of antitrust law. But there's nothing in the hypothetical you've described, as I understand it, that involves expanding the physical or the temporal scope of the patents, or that involves imposing restrictions on a licensee in any way.
Even though one technology patent was suppressed over another. Only one patent was used and the other was suppressed.
Well, yes, and I think in your hypothetical you said that they jointly developed a bunch of technology and then decided, they picked and chose and decided which ones to use and what to market. And it seems to me that that would be a classic, it's very much like this case really, and it would be a classic ancillary restraint case. Now, I'm not saying necessarily survive review, right? You can bring that challenge, but when you articulate it, the defendant says, look, it was a legitimate decision that we made as part of our joint activity, and this was ancillary to that. And then the other side has to make a showing of anti-competitive effect. Now, in the right circumstance, which maybe you're describing, if you have a very concentrated market, and if this is really a viable technology, maybe they can make that showing. And then maybe you end up in a debate about, on balance, should we encourage this or should we not encourage this? Is this more or less pro-competitive at the end of the day?
Are you suggesting under that circumstance it could be patent misuse to try to protect the Orange Book patents and the technology that they represent from competition from other people? Could that be patent misuse of the Orange Book patents? And I'm not just talking about the Rainmakers patents. I'm talking about the entire Orange Book patents that are being asserted here.
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning.
Could it be patent misuse if you're asserting, let's say in this case, the Orange Book patents, to protect those patents, to give those patents a broader scope by protecting them from competition? Could that be patent misuse?
We would say no, that is not the proper, that's not the historical, and it's not a proper.
But why isn't that expanding the scope of the patent? Suppose I own two patents, one analog, one digital. And I tell you, oh, you want to license the digital, you can only do it if you also license the analog. I'll bundle them together, you got to license both or you can't license either. Would that possibly be patent misuse?
Well, yes, if you are tying the two patents together.
So why isn't this similarly tying when you put them both in the pool, even though one of them is relevant to the standard and one of them is not?
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, now we're to a very different question, I think. So, first of all, the Wagner patent is relevant to the pool, has been found to be relevant to the pool, has been found by this court to be at least arguably relevant to the pool and therefore legitimately in the pool. That is clearly correct. The late-breaking claim construction argument we have from the other brief is not correct.
Okay, if it wasn't relevant to the pool, suppose, let's try and go with the hypothetical. Suppose it wasn't relevant to the pool. Now, would it be patent misuse? You've got...
If you have a plausible theory about why, by including it in the pool, you imposed conditions on the licensees that were anti-competitive and effectively expanded the scope of the legitimate patents, you can make out a misuse case. Here, under the particular conditions of this license, as was extensively discussed in Phillips 1, if it is an irrelevant patent, it's just an irrelevant patent. Now, the only thing that anyone has ever...
So inclusion, just so I understand it, inclusion of an irrelevant patent in the pool could be grounds for misuse, assuming anti-competitive effects are established.
Right. They would have to be very different facts from the facts here. But
so the key difference
is time misuse, because what you're doing is imposing conditions on the licensee and requiring the licensee in order to get access to the patent it wants.
So a horizontal agreement can give rise to misuse with anti-competitive effects, just like, you know, the one I described. A horizontal agreement to affect that can give rise to misuse with as long as there are anti-competitive effects.
Well, I
understand your point.
No, I interpret. I just want to be careful about the horizontal versus vertical, because I assume you're right that it implies some horizontal agreement among the licensors. But what I was focusing on is the fact that it entails a vertical agreement, if you want to call it that, between the licensors as a group and the licensee. And that's where I think you get the nexus that's necessary for misuse. It's the fact that you are imposing the conditions on the licensee in a way that broadens one of the licensed patents that gives you the potential nexus for misuse. It's not the fact that the licensors had to come to an agreement in order to put it in the pool.
Mr. Dumont, much of our conversation with you has been more focused on antitrust than patent misuse. Looking at it from that broad scope, do you see pro-competitive as well as anti-competitive implications in the sort of fact patterns we've been discussing? And what are they?
I'm not quite sure I'm following the question.
What pro-competitive implications were there and what happened between Sony and Philips?
Well, if we start with the fact that they created the CD, move forward to the fact that they then jointly worked on the CDR and CDRW technology and created that. And by the way, the market was in ferment at the time. It's not as though there weren't other technologies out there competing. There were, and some of them were from Sony, by the way. So just in case anyone thinks we weren't competing with Sony, we were doing both. But the pro-competitive benefits that came out of that collaboration included the genesis of the technology, and then you move forward to the putting together of the standard and of the joint license that enabled that standard, and you can look at our fact statement. So you have a situation where the technology comes out of nowhere and goes from disks being $4 to $7 a disk in 1995, I think it is, down to the time when the reason we have this entire fight with Printo is that the price of the disks goes down to pennies, and they then complain that the royalty is too high.
The question has been answered. Time has expired.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you very much.